Perfection was to be considered on a more ethereal realm than mere competition. Winning was part of it, but not all of it. His mother, Matilda, had instilled in Lombardi an anxious perfectionism. The Jesuits had taught him that human perfection was unattainable, but that all human beings should still work toward it by using their God-given capacities to the fullest. While complete victory can never be won, Lombardi said, it must be pursued. It must be wooed with all of one's might. Each week there's a new encounter. Each year there's a new challenge. But all of the display, all of the noise, all of the glamour, and all of the color and excitement, they exist only in the memory. But the spirit, the will to excel, the will to win, they endure. They last forever. These are the qualities, I think, that are larger and more important than any of the events that occasion them.
David Marinus's book, When Pride Still Mattered, reveals Green Bay Packers coach Vince Lombardi as a coach for whom football was the expression of philosophy. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Even for someone who's never watched a Green Bay Packers game, Vince Lombardi has meaningful things to say about winning, resolution, violence, competition, striving for perfection, the conflict between authority and freedom, leadership, character, and will. And how does that philosophy translate into an engaging portrayal of Lombardi on stage? We have three guests who have found out. They are David Marinus, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and associate editor of The Washington Post, Oscar-winning documentary film producer and playwright Eric Simonson, and Richard Corley, director of the Madison Repertory Theater production of Eric's play, Lombardi, The Only Thing.
And welcome to all of you to University of the Air.
Thank you.
It strikes me as unusual to get to talk simultaneously, really, to the author, the playwright, and the director of one production. I would think it makes sense to start with the author of the book, sort of to go back in time sequence here. To your book, David Marinus, can you tell us about your main idea in When Pride Still Mattered and why a book about Lombardi would be something that somebody not interested in football would find of interest?
Well, first of all, I grew up in Wisconsin. Lombardi was a huge figure in my youth, but, you know, I loved Brett Favre now, and I'll never write a book about him. It was not because Lombardi was a winning football coach that I wanted to write about him, but because I saw in Lombardi both the arc of an interesting life, but more important, a chance to write about the mythology of competition and success in American life, what it's cost. And through Lombardi's life, I think you can really do that. And that's what really brought me into the story.
What about that maxim that's always associated with him, that winning isn't everything, it's the only thing?
Well, everyone who goes to the play will hear the real story of the derivation of that phrase, because Eric was kind enough to put the explanation into the play. Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing was not coined by Vince Lombardi. It was in a really bad B-movie starring John Wayne called Trouble Along the Way, in which a 14-year-old actress uttered those words to Donna Reed, who was playing a social worker. And it somehow got into the realm of sports maxims after that and was attributed to Vince Lombardi.
Well, Donna Reed was kind of a winner, you know, in her own way.
I mean, that's not to say that Lombardi wasn't obsessed with winning, but he was much more complicated than that. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to strip away the mythology and stereotypes. I mean, Lombardi, because he succeeded during the 1960s, you know, a very tumultuous era, he was misrepresented by all sides. Nixon thought he was the archetype of the old way in discipline, and once tried even to get him find out whether he could run for vice president with Richard Nixon, until John Mitchell came back and informed Nixon that Lombardi was a Kennedy Democrat. And the counterculture, you know, of which I was sort of a modest member as a kid, you know, thought of Lombardi as the representative of a win-at-all-costs pathology, which was not him either. So he was neither of those things.
But he was, as you point out in your book and as you point out in your play, too, as I recall, Eric, he was big on expressing the importance of authority. He said, in effect, that in the 60s we had gone too far from authority for the sake of freedom, and then that freedom in turn became a kind of slavery. It almost sounds like something out of 1984 by the time 1967 comes along and he makes that speech.
The 60s were mind-boggling to Lombardi. His whole mindset was based on the Jesuit philosophy of the 1930s, which leads me into Eric because he takes that part of the book in wonderful ways.
Well, let's actually go to you, Rick, in terms of how you commissioned a play and got Eric involved. So you had read this book about Lombardi, and what led you to commission a work for the Madison Repertory Theater?
Well, I read the book when I first moved here a little over 5 years ago, and I just thought it would be wonderful to create a play from the book because it's so complex and theater deals so wonderfully with ideas. And when I met with David, we talked a lot about how it was really important that this be a play that dealt with the all of the sides of the man that are in the book and not a kind of a cheerleading expression of who he was. And so I began to look for a writer who could do that. And through a mutual friend of ours, another playwright, came to Eric. And it's wonderful because Eric is not only a terrific writer and also a director, but grew up in Wisconsin and knows the turf and knows the territory and loves the subject. These things are always wonderful risks, and you just sort of jump in and say, well, let's see what happens. And in this particular case, we're all very happy about the outcome because it's been a great process all along that started about 2.5 years ago. We did a reading and a workshop in last year's New Play Festival, and now we have a world premiere.
Well, Eric, how did you go about this? Because being from Wisconsin, you knew what a big subject this was. And having even looked at David's book, you know what a complex subject there is to deal with, how much is packed into that book. Where do you begin to turn it into a play?
Well, that was a challenge, I guess, because when I talked to Rick about doing a play, and he mentioned that he had David's participation or potential participation in the project. And I knew David's book. I think I bought it. I told David Buesen, I think I bought it the first day it was out on the bookstands. I was so enamored of Vince Lombardi and growing up with him and everything. But the challenge was, how do you tell this man's story? Because that's what the biography was, and it was a very compelling story to tell. And when Richard and I spoke initially, he said he wanted to find out what it was that made Lombardi Lombardi. And I'd done a play about Frank Lloyd Wright a few years back with Jeff Hatchery. He's the one who introduced me to Rick in the project eventually. And with Frank Lloyd Wright, you had many events in his life that made him who he was, you know, a very sort of tragic death of the love of his life. You could pick one of five tragic events really important events that sort of made him who he was. When you look at Lombardi's life, there isn't that one event that made him who he was. He was molded and shaped by the people around him and really who he was and his culture and where he grew up. But there wasn't that one dramatic moment.
So your work just got harder.
Yeah, exactly. I had to like try to find that. And when he came to the Packers, all he did was win. So where's the drama in that? But that led me to the idea of, well, you know, what makes a person that person who has the ability to always win? And there was a little blip in Lombardi's career in the middle after he'd won two championships. There were 2 years where he did not win the championship. I mean, he had winning seasons. He came in second. But it absolutely killed him that he wasn't the champion. And that was his goal. It was not just to be champion. It was to be champion always. So I took that little moment and put a microscope under it and tried to make that the drama.
The crisis.
The crisis.
And this would be what, in 1965?
The 63 and 64 seasons. But the play starts at the end of the 64 season, which is January 65.
Well, let me ask you about the process, because I would think it'd be hard to go if you're an author of a book. And then you see somebody adapting it and working with it and changing it for the sake of the stage. Isn't that a little bit painful at times?
I think it would be much more painful if it was an attempt to be a precise recreation of the book. There have been some screenplays, thank God, that have never been made of the book for movies that were disastrous when I read them, and I hated them. I mean, they have things like a scene where it was supposed to show a few black players in Green Bay being discriminated against. they were using the names of real Packers, and the Packers they were using were actually white players. The screenwriter didn't even know the difference. And so that was sort of a little signal that this guy really doesn't know this stuff. But no, for a play is totally different. My daughter's an actress. I'm not in theater, but I love it, and I know what a play is supposed to do. And Eric, when we first talked, my memory of that telephone conversation was that he was a little nervous because he said, you know, I've done something a little different here. I'm not sure you're going to like it. And when he said that, I knew I would love it. And in fact, I did. I'm so glad that he took it in a way that a play should go, which is into a totally creative realm where the thoughts and themes and ideas of the book are there. And even some of the words, even that little bit I wrote there, I noticed that one of the phrases is in the play, you know, in a different context, but it's the same words. So all of that is there, but plays are there to make you think and challenge you in ways that just a one-act play often can't, or a play that just recreates someone's life in its exactitude.
Did you do this without a single football on stage, right? I don't think there's a single...
Well, we do have a man in shoulder pads.
Jimmy
there
Taylor.
There is no football. I never thought about that, though. Maybe there's we should put one in.
There's even blood in his, his jersey.
There's no play-by-play. There's no radio or TV in the corner that's given
no,
you
No, I mean, this
it's
is very different.
A different
for,
plane.
I mean, for example, there's a play in Pittsburgh that's very popular called The Chief that's about Art Rooney. Right. Who owned the Pittsburgh Steelers. And in that play, and this is very typical of the way these kind of plays often are, you know, Art Rooney sits at a desk and talks about his great career and how much he loved the Steelers and all of that stuff. And, you know, everybody just sort of laughs and has a good time and everything. But, you know, it's really awfully boring, isn't it? I mean, to think of something like that. So in this play, there's a woman and there's a saint and there's a JFK. And, you know, there's a whole lot of sort of wonderful, magical things that are going on that are much more interesting.
Eric, when you're attending a performance of one of your plays or one of the read-throughs of this play, how do you gauge the audience reaction? How do you react to the way the audience reacts?
Well, I try to find a place in the theater where I can either watch the audience or I can sit among them, which is really hard. It's something that a friend of mine told me that he learned from writing at the O'Neill Center out at Cape Cod, which is one of the preeminent places to develop a play. Lloyd Richards, who ran it, used to make his playwrights sit right in the middle of the audience during the read-throughs, which can be really hard. I think it's very helpful. And it's not, you know, the more I do this, the less, the more I'm able to remove myself from, you know, emotionally from what might be going on stage, just to sort of try to get a better perspective on things, more objective.
So what kind of change would you foresee after a night or two in the audience?
What change would happen from performance to performance? Well, first off, once you get an audience in there, it's a huge jump in the process of putting up a play. The audience is like another character in the play, and they're going to give the actors certain cues through how they respond. And the actors will adjust. They'll adjust, you know, through direction. They'll adjust just by way of their own instincts.
So, for example, if there's a laugh line, the actors would slow it down so that the next line isn't buried by the laugh.
Exactly. You know, last night we had a preview. And, for example, there's a part in the play where Paul Horning, who's not, you know, he's a charming fellow, but he's not the brightest bulb in the shop. Makes a mistake by saying to Lombardi, sorry, coach, I wasn't being impermanent. And he means to say impertinent. And Phil Bingston, the assistant coach who's in the room, corrects him and says that's impertinent. Everyone in the cast thought the laugh would come after Phil Bingston corrected him.
Right.
But last night the laugh came immediately after.
They got it.
Yeah, they got it. So we think and therefore, because they were laughing when Paul Horning said impermanent, nobody could hear Phil Bingston say correct him. So there may be two laughs there. And I'm sure tonight the actor will make an adjustment and we'll find out if there are two laughs there. But at least we know that the audience is actually caught up with us at that point.
I guess the trick might be that audiences vary from night to night, don't they? They tend to have maybe a personality of their own.
Yeah, it's like if you're auditioning different people for the same part, every audience is like a different actor. They come in and they give their own energy. And I actually know when I'm – go see a play. I know when I'm part of a really bad audience or a misbehaving audience. You can just feel it. You know there are funny parts and you don't laugh because you kind of sense the people around you aren't going to laugh.
Right.
You take you know you're an organism. You're one part of an organism and you just – there's no way around it. You have to be a part of that. I mean, it's like, you know, Rumsfeld said about the army. You don't pick your army. You join the army that's there. It's like you don't pick your audience. You have to be in the audience that you get.
It's early in the run, I realize, but do you ever think about how this might adapt for radio or for television or some of the
– I actually think it'd be an excellent radio play.
Let's talk.
Okay. Because it really is it's a play of ideas, and in the middle of the play, the meat of the play, you have these different characters and they're arguing points of view. And that's the way I wrote it. You know, a lot of my earlier plays are not written that way, and it's kind of a slow lesson that I learned is that, you know, the reason why they call an audience is because of the, you know, root of audio. People are there to sit and listen, and that's why they call a video. And, well, motion picture is pretty obvious, but you're watching something. You use your eyes. In theater, you're using your ears. It's a first order business.
Well, can you take us into the theater? And if we arrive at the Madison Repertory Theater to see this play, in terms of visually, the set and the first thing that we're going to see come out at us, just the way with the last production you did, Death of a Salesman, you know, we got into that opening scene with Willie and Linda and the minimalist choices you had made in terms of the austere setting. What about for this play?
Well, this play starts with Lombardi in the middle of the night, not being able to sleep and recounting to us the dreams he has or the dream he's having, which is a sort of seeing a play run over and over in his mind and knowing that you can't sort of stop the real film and make the thing right, but he can't help but do it. So we start out with that image of him in crisis and that image of him in a sense in that long night of the soul. Then it moves forward into this time that we talked about earlier at the end of the season after this particular game called the playoff bowl. It takes place quite realistically in the bowels of the stadium in an office. And then that sort of gets exploded and we go to this airport. And that's in a way the most magical realm of the play and in the centerpiece of the play, this airport scene. So I think in a way it starts off I don't want to say it starts off realistically, but it starts out in a way that you are following his story and his thought process, and then it takes you to a completely different place.
You ruled out, Eric, you ruled out right away the idea of just doing a one-man show.
Oh, I wouldn't have been able to – I couldn't have written it. It's just not my style. I'm not a big fan of one-man shows. When I start out to write a play or work on a play, it's always got to be something that I would want to see.
That's a good premise.
Yeah. I wouldn't see a one-man show about Vince Lombardi. It just would not interest me.
All right. On the other hand, you bring in a woman, and I gather from David's book that women weren't, you know, a big crisis part of Lombardi's life. Seems to have had a pretty routine life.
But that's why it's interesting to bring a woman in. I mean, I think
that's not quite true. Actually, he could have taken it in a different direction and used Lombardi's wife as a character in the book, and she was a crisis. She twice overdosed on sleeping pills and was had trouble drinking, and her dealing with the great man was an interesting, complex situation where she loved being his wife but also struggled with it, as did his entire family. It's a different play. The one that Eric decided to write, I think, is better than that because all of the characters in it in some way or another are different aspects of Lombardi's, the competing ideas of his mind.
Of his own personality.
And so when you watch that opening scene, David, in the play,
right,
knowing all that you know that went behind the writing of your book, what do you see about Lombardi that comes out in the opening thoughts that he's having that night? And I mean, what lies behind it?
The obsession with perfectionism. They could have had him cleaning a closet, which is something else he did at 3 in the morning. But that would – reading cookbooks, right? That's where his other two things he'd do when he was just totally at sea about losing or trying to figure out how to win again. But I think that opening prologue is very realistic. And I felt – and by the way, we haven't mentioned the actors at all yet, but Jeff Still, who plays Lombardi, is really something and has a – power and subtlety to him that I love. And so when I see him come out on stage, it's not just because of the costume and the way they've got his hair now and the glasses and his teeth and everything, but just his essence, I feel.
And what is that essence?
An awful lot of nervous energy and an incredibly deep desire to prove himself. I mean, you know, Eric's sense that there's not that crisis moment in Lombardi until this moment is absolutely true, but he was 45 years old when he got his chance with the Packers. He was about to give up and become a bank teller in New Jersey. He'd been frustrated for 20 years, feeling he'd been discriminated against because an Italian-American or passed over because of his temper.
He was an assistant coach for 20 years.
He was a high school football coach, then an assistant at Fordham, then an assistant at West Point, which is another key moment in his life, which is in the play, because his mentor there was Red Blake, who was a famous college football coach with a own philosophy and imparted it on Lombardi. Then he was an assistant with the New York Giants for 4 years and really never got his shot. So that when he did sort of turn the American myth on its end, it's usually the small town kid who goes to New York to make good. And it was Lombardi, a New Yorker, going to Little Green Bay to have this incredible transcendent period. When he did it, he had this enormous pent up energy to prove himself, and it's just constant. That's why he couldn't sleep. And it's what killed him. You know, I mean, he was only, you know, he started in 1959. 11 years later, he was dead. You know, but he just did. He had this fire in him that just fueled him for that period.
How do we account for that fire? And I mean, was it mostly a desire, as you say, to prove himself, or was there something more fundamental than that that drove him?
I think it was, like David said, it's pent up. He had a savings account for this anguish, and he kept on making installments over the course of his long life. I mean, it was, you know, the things that David mentioned, the discrimination that he felt was against him. And I think everyone can sort of relate to the idea that they're not getting their shot. Well, he really didn't get his shot. He just proved himself over and over and over and over again and was continually recommended by head coaches that he was working under and passed over for jobs that he should have had. So it was that accumulation, I think, of angst.
And how do you use the Catholicism to shed light on his character?
Well, it's a huge part of his life, his being. He went to Mass every day. And I think when he goes into this other – in the play, he goes into sort of a hyper – consciousness. And the people that he meets, encounters, there are four sort of influences in his life. Three of them are Catholic in a big way. One of them isn't. But he went to a Catholic school, Fordham, and that's where he was taught the Jesuit principles. So it's not just a religion, it was a philosophy for him.
How does that relate to the winning philosophy?
Well, the Jesuit philosophy is directly transplanted to his philosophy about winning football. There's this idea of freedom through discipline and trying to attain perfection, not a sort of achieving perfection, but the journey is more important than actually attaining that perfection and finding God through perfection. I mean, that was a huge thing for Lombardi and frustrated him no end because, you know, you can't be perfect when you're leading men who are potentially all imperfect.
In the play, the rosary, the benediction, everything is the Packer sweep. It's a specific play. And it is both the symbol of Lombardi and of the Green Bay Packers and representative of the Jesuit philosophy. And the play really brings that out in a very cool way and that Eric wrote and that Rick found a neat way to present.
I know you said that the winning isn't everything was not actually what he said. I mean, that it's misattributed. But I've seen all these quotes where, you know, if you put Vince Lombardi into Google, it'll pull up hundreds of quotes about show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser, the idea that there is no such thing as a good loser.
Every comical statement in baseball is attributed to Yogi Berra, right?
Yeah.
Whether he said them or not. And every motivational thing in football is attributed to Vince Lombardi. I mean, he certainly had some of that, but most of those were long before Lombardi came along. And he was obsessed with winning. But his players would, you know, I interviewed most of the players who played for him who were still alive, and to a person they said, "The toughest Lombardi ever was on us when we won a game but didn't play well."
Yeah, I think in terms of the quotes, if you really want to get to the heart of Lombardi, the longer the quote, the more you'll find out more about him. And one of the reasons before Rick even came to me about potentially writing this play, I knew those quotes. I memorized them because I don't have a good memory. But I did read them over, you know, when I would go to them for inspiration. And they're really the ones that are the best are the ones where he talks about a man's love for another man. And how do you love, say, so this is in the play actually, but how do you, it's easy to love something perfect, but the quality of love is really, the standard of love is how do you love something that's imperfect? And those sort of things. There's that. And also, when you read these quotes, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to do a play, is there's a kind of an energy, an internal combustion engine to these quotes. And Lombardi wasn't a writer. He wasn't a speech. He just sort of had an instinct for, in a kind of not a Shakespearean way, but a very American way of lifting words into a kind of a whirlwind where they had an energy of their own.
Well, that certainly plays into your hands, doesn't it?
As makes a playwright. My job easy.
But for Rick, how important is action, physical action in this play? Again, there's kind of an irony in a way because this guy is all about violence. I mean, he says to correct me if I'm wrong, but he says to play football without violence is absurd.
Yes, but the violence, I mean, again, this is what's interesting about him. When you take the word love and you take the word violence and you look at those two things, and Lombardi was able to talk about those two things together, to synthesize those two thoughts in a way, and you see it in the play. You see that idea of brotherhood and the idea of loving the person next to you, though that person be imperfect. And those kind of things are not the things that you would expect to hear from Lombardi, but they really are Lombardi. In terms of staging it, Eric provided a very clear blueprint for how we should do this play, which is that, as we talked about it, he was very influenced by a play of Shaw's Don Juan in Hell, which is a part of Man and Superman, and that provides the opportunity sort of in the midst of the action of Man and Superman for the play to become a real, in a sense, idea debate. And what's thrilling about this play is that plays these days don't often deal with ideas in that way. They tend to not allow characters to really express ideas in an active way. When you see really good plays of Shaw's done really well, the ideas have become extremely active and the passion behind the ideas makes them really come alive. And I kept saying that to the actors. I said, look, the ideas in this play have to be a matter of life and death to all of you. You have to really be incredibly invested in getting Vince to understand these ideas. And then the intellectual fervor of the play becomes the heart of the play. It really comes to life. The centerpiece of the play is a wonderful fusillade of ideas, which is really exciting to put
part
on
of
stage.
That, there is part of the discussion where they get into the violence of football and the number of deaths that have even occurred because of football. And the way Eric has written it, that becomes comedy. The single most depressing thought in the whole play makes everybody laugh because of the way St. Ignatius delivers a response to the death and deaths that are caused by football. But at that moment in the play when all of those characters are sitting around, I find it thrilling because the ideas are coming at you so fast.
And from different
perspectives.
Different parts of history, for that matter. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get into that cast of characters in a minute when we return. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Collaborative Family Law Council of Wisconsin, an association of lawyers and mental health and financial specialists dedicated to resolving divorce and family law issues respectfully for the entire family. 866-265-5529.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests. There are three of them for this edition of University of the Year. We have with us author David Marinus, who wrote the book When Pride Still Mattered. We have playwright Eric Simonson, who used that book as part of the inspiration for his play Lombardi, The Only Thing, which is in progress at the Madison Repertory Theater. And we have Richard Corley, the director of that production, Lombardi, The Only Thing. We've already referred to some of the characters in here, and if you're talking about Vince Lombardi, you're not thinking necessarily about St. Ignatius, and you're not necessarily thinking about this character that Sarah Phillips plays. We've already said that his wife could easily have been a character in this, but instead you chose somebody else. So who do we have here in this interesting mix?
Well, in Lombardi's real world, we have Lombardi. We have Jim Taylor, his star fullback from the glory days, and Paul Horning, his favorite ball player, again, from the glory days. And then Phil Bengston, his assistant coach, defense coach. And Bud Lee is in the play. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, still is, but the character is not really him. It's a composite of a bunch of reporters that I drew from David's book.
And do I need to know football to understand the conversations between Vince Lombardi and some of the other players happening on stage?
No, you don't. I mean, really, it's the eternal labor struggle, the scene that we were met with initially between players and owners, or in this case, the coach and the owners. And that was a very interesting time, the early 60s, mid-60s, when football was becoming a national sport and there was money being poured into it from all corners, mostly from televised games. But anyway, there was all this money flooding in, and the players weren't really seeing any of it. So the conversation that happens initially is really a conflict between a player who's not very bright in the play. I mean,
nor in real life.
Okay. Jim Taylor. Won't mention any names, but Jim Taylor, who wants more money, sees new players getting $500,000, and I don't know what his pay scale was at that time, but it was
50, maybe.
Yeah, tenth max of that. And he confronts Lombardi, the scariest man on the planet to him. And Lombardi is of the opinion that if Jim Taylor really wants to play for the Packers, he'll do it out of pride, and money is not an issue. And he holds firm to that. So I don't think it takes a sports fan to understand that. And if you know anything about what the pay scale of professional players these days, it will be of some interest.
Now,
at the start of that.
Lombardi, you mentioned Paul Horning, of course, as his favorite player, but he did have to give him up, didn't he? Is that reflected?
It sort of happened by accident, David May.
That's not in the play. The play is before that point, but the play sort of gives you a sense of what might happen with Taylor and Horning when there was an expansion draft for when the New Orleans Saints came into football. Lombardi put Horning in the draft, assuming that he wouldn't get chosen because he was injured. And in fact, Horning, even though he loved Lombardi, manipulated his way. He wanted to go to New Orleans. And so he asked them to draft him, and they did. And it broke Lombardi's heart.
Well, he wanted to go to New Orleans because he knew he'd get a big paycheck.
Big paycheck there.
So we're back to pride versus money again.
Exactly, which goes through the book. And at the same time, in the play, Lombardi is being courted to go be the coach of the New York Jets and being offered a lot more money. So you see it from both ends.
And, of course, for him, it's a return to home. It would be to go back to New York, which actually he didn't end up doing that, did he? He wound up in Washington.
Went to Washington, but for the same reason, for control, power. He went there because he was given 13% ownership of the Redskins.
And as it turned out, that was...
And this is the play takes place at the moment when he's first starting to see that player agents are becoming factors in his life and that he could lose control because of money and agents and players getting more power. And so this 65 January is the start of that. And at the end of his career, which is only a few years later, he leaves Green Bay because he wants that power. And he can't get it there because the people own the Packers. He can't be the owner.
So in a sense, he has to buy into the power and money principle
exactly. In
order to get what he wants, which is the control, which would give him the pride.
And the play takes place at the beginning of that sort of struggle.
And who else is in the cast of characters then? We've got
Then we go to this, what I described as a hyper consciousness in the middle of the play where Lombardi is met with St. Ignatius, a 16th century Catholic saint who started the Jesuit sect, and John F. Kennedy. He meets his father, Harry, who appears to him as 30 years younger than he really is, and his old head coach mentor, Red Blake. And they form a kind of committee of mentors that help Lombardi unravel the knot that he's found himself in.
And Rick, how do you stage it so that this hyper conscious world looks?
I don't remember any smoke.
I mean, what do you do smoke. So that we know when we're not in the real world?
Well, we talked a lot about that, but eventually I think we made the right choice, which was to treat it realistically and then allow the events that happen to be the unrealistic part of it. I mean, obviously, you know, when somebody says, and you truly believe they're St. Ignatius, you're not in realism anymore.
But you don't
you're
have
not
funny
in Kansas
lights
anymore.
Or,
no, we don't have funny lights. I mean, there is a blackout sort of as he loses consciousness and so on, but it's not obvious in that way in terms of funny lights. But I think what's interesting, you know, Eric set that scene in an airport, and on the most basic level, an airport is a place that you go to go to another world. It's a kind of stopover point. And there's a line in the play where Lombardi says, you know, where am I basically? And somebody says, you're on the cusp of the quick and the dead. The
A layover for the tormented.
Layover for the tormented.
I've
yes,
had airport sure. experiences
yeah, we've been
like
there.
That.
Between life and death, yes. That's what it is, but we don't do anything Alice in Wonderland like to make that happen. It's just that the characters are the characters. And that's when you see Lombardi's dad come in, you know, 30 years younger in a bloody butcher's apron. He was a butcher in Brooklyn. You know, you sort of know you're not talking about real world. But still, the ideas and the thoughts and the conversations and the characters are behaving very realistically. And, of course, then there's Ava, the woman.
She appears in both worlds, actually. And I always forget the mythological character who ushers people across the river.
Charon.
Charon, yes.
Yeah. Is that kind of – that's the idea is that she's an angel of sorts who has the ability to take Vince to where he wants to go. And he actually has a decision to make at the end whether he wants to make that voyage across the river or not. And she's beautiful. And she plays Paul Horning's girlfriend in real life, a stewardess. And in the other world, she reminds everyone of their mother. She's representative, but she, in a way, she has a very specific task.
And does that come from your book at all, David? No, this is a complete...
It's in the footnotes.
That was David's first question after you read the play. Who is Ava?
Well, I mean, that...
But it works, and so it didn't bother me in the least.
No, I mean, I'm assuming, Eric, that the play is not so much based on the book, or the book is a major source for ideas about the play. I mean, you researched...
I bought a bunch of books on Jesuit philosophy and other things, but David's book was my main source.
But I'd be interested in hearing about some of the conversations you and David had as he looked at the play. Did you look at it at all before it was finished, David?
It was in a very early stage, I think, when he first sent it to me.
The first draft.
Yeah.
Is that a little scary?
It's frightening. It's absolutely frightening.
I'm terrible at reading plays, first of all. I mean, actually reading them. Mm-hmm. It's such a different art form from nonfiction narrative that most plays look bad to me, even if they're really good, because I don't know how to read them right or visualize them.
You have to visualize the action.
But this one didn't. Actually, I got it, and it excited me from the beginning, and that was unusual for me because I'm so stupid about plays. my daughter's an actor. She can read them and knows exactly, and I don't, you know, and so I always feel certain.
So what was your first reaction when you talked to Eric? What did you
I
say?
I said, I love the St. Ignatius. You know, I'm so happy that you picked up on that because I think it's so, you know, so central to my concept of Lombardi. And I think I did ask, what's Ava?
Yeah.
What's
Ava?
I would think one of the hard things, and this comes up over and over again, for example, if there's a movie Becoming Jane about Jane Austen that messes with the facts, or if there's the hoax about Howard Hughes and which things really happen. If you're doing a play about Lombardi, to what extent did you feel free to take liberty with the facts to create things that didn't happen? I mean, is there...
I didn't feel at liberty to mess with the facts because the facts are the facts. But I felt a certain amount of freedom to take a flight of fancy in how that story would be expressed. freedom through discipline.
Sounds like Lombardi.
Yeah.
But this is coming up a lot, you know, biographers putting themselves into the story of Reagan or, you know, as if they were a character.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that this is a really different case mm-hmm. because there's a very clear delineation in this play where you know that this is a kind of fantasy, a clear untruth meant to tell a bigger truth. And I think what you're talking about, Emily, are the times when it's hard to tell the difference. If you don't know about Jane Austen and you see that movie, you might think that's what really happened because they don't tell you any mm-hmm. differently. Eric very clearly tells you that right. this is not
It's not real. A biopic.
I was not in the room. I was not in the room when Vince Lombardi spoke to Sidney.
Yeah, but the conversations that are, in a sense, more realistic that happen in the play – there's nothing that takes place in those conversations that I would say is not based on the factual
understanding of the history. There's some little liberties that they take too. And Rick and I had a very minor debate over
the chair,
whether there's a great scene where Jimmy Taylor is lured into Lombardi's chair and he's massaging him while he's trying to get him to change his perspective. And I wrote a note to Rick saying, nobody would ever, ever, ever sit in Lombardi's chair, which is true. But theatrically, it works. And so it's not, you know, it's no big deal.
Yeah, it heightens the stakes.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. he's doing something that he would never do, putting a player in his own chair. It heightens the stakes. But yeah, little things like that. But it's not like inventing another character who didn't exist or that sort of thing.
Rick, how far do you go with, since so many of these characters based on real people are known so well today, how far do you go with trying to duplicate, say, John F. Kennedy in the terms of his look and his sound?
Well, you know, what Eric and I have talked about is that these people that we really know, Lombardi is one and Kennedy is one, there has to be enough mimetic quality that you sort of go, okay, that's JFK. I get it.
Works for the Simpsons.
The accent has got to be very good, and the guy's got to look pretty reasonably like Lombardi or Kennedy or whatever. And our actors, Michael and Jeff, do. And Michael also looks tremendously like Paul Hornung, amazingly. And so they have that, but I also think it's really important that you go beyond that because that's interesting. You know, if you see it in a Saturday Night Live skit and you kind of go, oh, you know, Phil Hartman really nailed Bill Clinton, that's really interesting for the 2 minutes of the Saturday Night Live skit. Uh-huh. But it's not going to be interesting for 2 hours on stage. It's got to be
– past the novelty.
Especially with Lombardi. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Less
it's got to be
Kennedy.
much richer kind of thing, and you sort of let the audience go, oh, okay, they can do that, and then just let it get beyond that and let it go.
I do have to ask, I mean, I am sort of curious. I didn't have to get too far into your book, David, before I thought, oh, yeah, I bet Lombardi was a really big Kennedy fan. Somehow it just seemed that he would be. And then, of course, you mentioned that Nixon considered him as a VP running mate until he found out about the Kennedy connection. How far do you go with that, Eric?
Well, with his relationship with Kennedy? I think I took it beyond probably what it was. They had a few encounters in real life. But, I mean, I think the admiration was there. He was Catholic. Well, he was Catholic.
I mean, philosophically, I can't quite reconcile them.
No, he was a Kennedy. I mean, he liked Bobby Kennedy, too. I mean, he was just a Kennedy guy. And, you know, he was old school in a lot of ways, but he was really strong on race relations and on human relations. He had a gay brother, and he was very strong on that, too, which people don't know, you know. But he had a player in Washington who was gay, and when he heard the assistant coaches were teasing this guy, he said, if I hear any more of that, you're fired. And with the black players in Green Bay, he went to the taverns in Green Bay and said, if I hear any of you are discriminating against my black players, they're, you know, off limits for all of my guys. So in those two realms, Lombardi was very strong, and maybe even stronger than John Kennedy, actually, but was a Kennedy Democrat in that sense. And the Catholicism cannot be overestimated.
From what I can tell.
And what did he get from his father? You know, you mentioned that he's a character in the play. I'm just curious, would Vince Lombardi have turned out the way he did without that father in terms of
– his dad was born in Naples, Italy. a small town outside of Naples. Came to the U.S. when he was two. Was a Brooklyn Dem Dees Does guy and a butcher and very tough. He got his perfectionism from his mother, as I read in that opening. Eric can talk about how he uses him in the play, but he got sort of that.
He has temper from him, too.
Temper from his dad, yeah.
It's completely shaped by his family,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Growing up between his mom and his dad and his surroundings, Brooklyn.
His father was this astonishingly strong man, body covered in tattoos, I think.
There's this incredible moment when I'm researching the book where somebody said he had tattoos on all of his fingers. And I got this picture of the family at a picnic. And I got a magnifying glass and looked into the, and I could see his fingers. And on one hand, it was W-O-R-K, and then the other was P-L-A-Y, work and play.
Wow.
You know,
taking
just,
it seriously.
It like, whoa, when I saw that. I
mean, he didn't have room to get St. Ignatius on there.
And he was tattooed. His nickname was Old 5x5.
He was what's just the story? He could pick up his kids with a
one hand
with a shovel or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
yeah,
how strong he
yeah,
was.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have a father like that who can cut, I don't know, what, dozen sides of beef in one day, just incredible. I mean, that must have an enormous influence over you.
How do the 60s come into play here? We're talking 1965, and it is a time we know that Lombardi, as this disciplinarian, is looking at a world that's coming apart in terms of rejecting authority. Does that come through in this play?
Absolutely. It's a very interesting moment in time in the country. Things are about to bust open. Yeah, it's a particular moment in time that fascinated me, not just in everything that was happening, but in particular in sports and in football that was happening. As I mentioned before, the television coming into play, and I forget what was the game that really changed things. There was one game that
That was in 58. It was the sudden death game. It was before that. But by 65, football was – and television were
– and it was just a confluence of events that made Lombardi sort of the centerpiece of professional football, the face that everyone recognized as the face of professional football.
But January 65 was kind of like, the play is about this layover or this, cusp, and that really is the cusp. I mean, the 60s as we know it, in terms of the counterculture and the summer of love and the protests, really start to intensify in the few years after that. 64, 65 is kind of right when things are.
Well, one thing that I'd written into the play was that Ava, when we first meet her, is wearing a miniskirt. And this came up in rehearsal.
They weren't there yet.
Yeah. I knew that when I wrote it, but I still wanted
You're just trying to sell some more tickets, aren't you?
She's still very beautifully and sexually dressed because the stewardess is – this is still in the early time when, being a stewardess was very glamorous. And
it was stewardess. It wasn't flight attendant.
It was stewardess, yes.
The sensibility was still more closer to 1960 than the 60s, as you know.
In
dress. I wrote a book about 1967 and the first protest here in Madison. And looking at the pictures, everybody had short hair and the men were wearing sport coats.
It surprises you, doesn't it, to look back?
Yeah,
we think about what we really think about the 60s is pretty much like maybe even
early
1970,
70s.
Yes.
71.
I guess I'm interested in how you think Lombardi emerges from, first of all, his own story through your book, David, but then also through the play. Is he sort of the hero of his own life? Did he, by the time he died, did he feel that he had been the kind of success he wanted? Were there demons that he had in those closets he was always cleaning?
Well, in the book, St. Ignatius tells him that he'll never conquer his anger, and that's very true. He never does.
In the play.
In the play. Yeah, you're right. And I think he's, a tragic hero in a sense. I mean, he certainly accomplished more. He became a mythological figure because of those 9 years in Green Bay. But he died. And he died too soon, partly because of his pride, because he wouldn't get, that's dealt with in the play, too. He's starting to get sick, and he won't get checked.
Why won't he get checked? Just
because he doesn't want to snake up a certain part of his anatomy.
It was an intestinal cancer.
It was colon cancer.
I think his life was cut short, and he didn't have time to reflect on his place in history.
But his players did. And one of the important schmaltzy but true testaments to Lombardi is that his players hated him on a daily basis and loved the hell out of him still and always will.
And you said that he did overemphasize winning in many ways, but as if that's sort of necessary to win. But are you worried about the message of Lombardi in the sense that if so much is invested in winning, is something lost? I mean, if you see God is sort of involved in the plan.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the Jesuits. But I'm not worried about that coming through. I'm interested by it. It's really one of the things that compelled or that draws me to David's biography and compelled me to write the play is that conversation about winning and in particular winning, what winning means in this country, winning at all costs, what it extracts from humanity and how it's something that's sort of eternal that we really can't get away from because it's part of our biology. And in a sense, the play depicts that struggle between a sort of violent physical nature and the struggle between that and what's going on in our head.
Yeah, the whole point of the book was that this is an interesting, particularly American issue. And rather than place Lombardi on one end of it as a stereotype, the book tries to make him in the middle of it and show the costs and the price of success and the rewards of it and the conflict of it. That's where Lombardi was, and that's what the play does as well. It's not – so, yes, of course, winning can be a pathology, you know, and in the play talks about it in a wonderful way. And, so, you know, taking a theme from the book of Bertolt Brecht talking about the black addiction of the brain, which is success, and you need more and more. It's an addiction. So, you know, that's the way to look at it as the center of a really interesting eternal debate within American life.
And, you know, plays, if they're any good, don't make statements about anyone in terms of heroic or unheroic. They ask questions. And this play is a good play. It asks questions of Lombardi, and in the end, those questions continue to reverberate. The culture sometimes doesn't ask the questions. It's up to the artist to ask the questions. So we're taking this figure who maybe, other than with David's great book, hasn't been examined enough, and hopefully the play will help people to see the greater dimensionality of this extraordinary American icon and why he is so fascinating.
Well, we wish you success with the play, but don't get addicted to it. Thanks for joining us this hour. It's been a great treat having author and playwright and director all in one, and they have been David Marinus and Eric Simonson and Richard Corley.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
And your play is going to be running through December 2nd at the Overture Center in Madison.
That's Lombardi, the only thing.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.